Hey, welcome, welcome,
welcome,
welcome to the Marshaverse. This is a place in the rest of the universe where I come to make shit make sense.
From the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, it's midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Gills Hudson, as the problem child. Hey, don't you know that the queen
is back? She's back, she's back. Good morning. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse. You know where we like to get together at the witching hour at that one time a day when we're between yesterday and tomorrow and still today. So we're going to celebrate this new day and talk about some of the things that happened in the old day. And we're going to do our little regular kind of little features. And then we're going to introduce our guest. I'm so excited to have her here. Ida Rodriguez is going to be here. Yay! Kermit, yay! Okay. And we're going to talk to her. She's one of my favorites, and she got a lot going on. We got a lot to talk about. So to get ready for all of that, and you know, this is my time of day. I am a night person. I am a night owl. I don't like daytime. I don't like happy daytime people. They're annoying, and they're so happy. And so I just like to sleep through when they are running the day. And wake up now and chill. You know, there's not a lot of noise and hubbub. You can think. And I like to have a little cannabis and cognac to kind of get into that chill mode because I'm a child of the 70s. Well, I'm a child of the 50s. But I came of age in the 70s where our whole goal was to chill. For us, rest was an act of rebellion. I ain't going nowhere. Meet no mule. I'm going to sit here and smoke this chill, which I think is a noble effort. We all need a little more chill. So tonight, I am going to, we're going to start with the cannabis. I'm not sure what kind of cart this is in my Whoop Fam, Zenko, but we're going to, it's so cute. Look at that. I love that. Here we go. You have to be careful with that. I'm being careful with it. Okay. And now, this is my favorite cognac. I don't know if I've told you, but I always liked Martell. And so I figured we'd bust this out tonight in our snifter. That's not club size. In the club, they give me like a gallon. And, oh, it's just a little shot. No, it's, and I always leave most of it because I can't do that no more. But I can do this. Here's a little to you if you're indulging. Whatever you got, a little coffee, a little soup. I don't care. I'm having a little cognac. Here we go. Okay. I told you I like that. Let's get started. Now, some of you may know that I am a comediosopher and sheologian, and those things come together in the Marshaverse and form a lot of the basis of a lot of my thinking. And I have a video that explains what I call sapphire spirit that I think every woman should own. Her sapphire spirit. It's meant to be, the word sapphire is meant to be a slur and it's offensive. But what it is something that's trying to minimize the power that other people see in you. So take a look at this video and then we'll come back and talk. Hi, welcome to the Book of Marsha, where everything I say is gospel. I'm Reverend Dr. Marsha Francine Warfield, comediosopher and sheologian. I matriculated from the Warfield School of Comedy at MFU, which of course stands for Marsha Francine University. UMF works too. It is in my capacity as the founder of the Church of Jesus that I come to you today and introduce you to a new denomination. So what had happened was, I was on Twitter going back and forth with friends, fans, and other people, and someone took exception to something I said. So they responded and called me a Karen. After I got through laughing, I informed them that I could not be a Karen, that I, in fact, am a motherfucking sapphire. Now, when I called myself a sapphire, I was fully aware of the stereotype of the angry black woman who emasculates men, and she speaks her mind, and she's not feminine, and all of those things. Amos and Andy had a character called Sapphire, and it was on TV when I was a little girl. I didn't like that show very much, but I remember the Sapphire character. But I wasn't really aware of how deeply entrenched the stereotype is, how long it has lasted, and the real impact of it and meaning. As I read more about the traditional trio of black woman stereotypes, the Mammy, the Jezebel, and Sapphire, I began to realize some pretty amazing and important things. These depictions are designed to neutralize the power of the people that they target. The stereotypical mammy in fiction and books doesn't take any guff from anyone, and that's okay. That's a power. The Jezebel is a temptress. She can lure any man into sin, even though she is the daughter, she is the young one. But Miss Sapphire, okay, so now you kind of get the feeling of where I'm coming from with this comediosophy, excuse me, and sheology. But I want to kind of relate it to what's going on nowadays. We have a president who is a stereotype. First of all, he's a not even a talk show host. He's a reality show host. He's a huckster. He's that's his milieu. That's where he fits best. But he is also the stereotypical ugly American. Ugly Americans, that was a book, and it described the way the world, rest of the world sees Americans with their big bullying bluster, loud, take over everything. Hey, we're the best ever. And the worst of that image seems to be what became MAGA, that bluster with not a lot of backup. You know, it's like it's not visceral. It's not a sense of self. It's a sense of bullying, of machismo, of just fake it till you make it kind of bluster. And he has glamorized and glorified that, made that somehow desirable. They want to be the guy, you're fired. They want to be the person who makes up names for people and then can't take it when they make up names for him. He wants to send them to Gitmo or wherever the hell he's sending people just because they're brown. And so it's like a lot of young people who kind of tipped the scales this time. They can't really be forgiven, but they have to be forgiven because they grew up at a time when he had already normalized this from the time they were children. So this kind of fake John Wayne-ness has been how younger people have grown up seeing themselves to aspire to be. So they don't see the right at the core of the ugly American president. And he's the first one, I don't know if people make enough of it, he's the first president in my lifetime who has only been president of some people. He never says, my fellow Americans. He never talks about the country as a unit, a country. He talks about the radical, demented left and the, you know, big, beautiful maggots. And those are the people who are running around with masks on, snatching people up out of the streets, cutting DEI or anything that shows how American history has not always been on the right side of history. And that they know doesn't make them the heroes that they've purported themselves to be through my industry and the news media very well. And education, they have taught these narratives with these stereotypes that we have come to believe, even if you don't want to, even if you can intellectualize it. There's something that's been indoctrinated in you with from everything from white Jesus to Aunt Jemima to Dad's Home. I mean, all of these stereotypes kind of teach us how to see the world and not ever consider that there are many other ways the world could be. You know, we don't have to be in that kind of mindset. And that's why I created the Marshaverse. This is the place where we can chill, where we don't live by schedules, where we don't think Dad's always right, and we don't have patriarchal, puritanical values. We believe all people have value. All people are people. And this bluster, silly, cock-a-the-walk, dick-swinging man, silly stereotype, has nowhere to go but to self-destruct. And it's going to self-destruct. But if we can get our minds into the Marshaverse, which is really the U-verse, it's you. It's about you making the world that you see. Because everything starts with a thought. Everything starts with a thought that's shared, that's compounded, that spreads, that soon becomes a thing. Everything we create, every joke you tell, you can speak it into existence. So we can have the chill world where we can get together at midnight and have a drink, a little cognac, talk a little smack, be among friends. And that's the kind of world I want to live in. So that's the kind of world I'm trying to show. And I'm happy that I have my sons, my oldest son who looks just like me, and my youngest son, my problem child. And you're going to meet them in a little while. But we have to, as people who are not in government, who are not, don't want to be, but who know what we want, that we want the kind of world we want, we have to start talking about that and agreeing on that. And soon you will make that a thing that can grow and spread and be. So I'm excited to get to my guest. So that's enough of that. We saw that. We're going to get back to it later, maybe. But right now, y'all ready? I want to introduce this lady. I became aware of her online and then saw her perform and talked to her and watched her. I'll let her tell you about it, but she's fascinating. And she's Puerto Rican, and so is my wife. And my wife is, tell I said I love her, tell I said I love her. So this is somebody my wife loves. Say hello to Ida Rodriguez. Good morning, honey.
Good morning.
Good morning, honey. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, every day is a winding road right now, but.
Okay. Well, how you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I, every day I make a choice, and Some days I don't know if I succeed much, but I choose every day to find my joy because we have no choice but to be okay.
Okay, now I don't know where to start. I love your voice, your activist voice, your comedy voice. I appreciate and respect and love that too. And could just, you know, that's more than enough. But when you combine it with your political activist womanness, I just appreciate that so much. But it seems like you pulled back on that for a little bit. Something happened.
First of all, thank you, because there would be no me if it wasn't for you. You are one of the reasons and one of my inspirations, you know, in what I do. I did not pull back. I just redirected my energy to the people who listen and the people that I want to talk to. I have no desire to be battle rapping with bitter balls on the internet. And I had to make some adjustments. I had this realization that a lot of people who are activists on social media are just doing that just for social media. And I feel like real activism is on the ground. There are a lot of people who wake up every morning to do the work, and I visit with it. So I wanted to make sure that I use my platform to shine the light on the people who actually do the work all the time, because I get to go play and as an actor, as a comedian, you know, and all of the other things, an author. And then, you know, people do this every single day, but there is not one day that I'm not committed to liberation.
Right. Well, I think I remember a quote when I was watching the Baldwin documentary that Samuel L. Jackson narrated. I thought he was brilliant as the narrator. I thought he made that whole thing. I was just blown away by the way they directed the whole thing. But there was a quote where James Baldwin was saying he was going down south with all of the, you know, civil rights activists, leaders. He's not just, you know, boots on the ground. He's with the leaders, and he was feeling some kind of way, you know. And then he said he realized there's somebody has to document everything.
That's right.
Somebody has to make this, to tell the story. And
that's right.
We sometimes undervalue our storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
You told your story. What made you write a book?
Well, somebody once told me that a book is your opportunity to tell your side of the story without rebuttal. And that was very enticing to me because for many years, I was dealing with a lot of trauma, a lot of things that happened. And I, out of consideration for my family and the people who did things to me, for some reason, those that were complicit in it happening, I had more consideration for them than I did for myself. And I had to take ownership and agency of my story and say, this is my story. This is me telling what happened to me from my perspective, and me sharing this is going to help somebody else who might be willing to sweep it under the rug because that's what they tell us to do. And I just was like, I'm going to let it out, because if I don't let it out, it's going to come out one way or the other. And I'd rather it come out in a productive way than in a way in the healthiest way possible. And that book was really freeing. My mother was like, I can't believe, you know, you told those things. And I'm like, you should be grateful, because of that I'm able to have a relationship with you.
Okay. I can't believe this stuff happened.
Oh yeah.
You know, why are you talking about me telling it, but ain't you kind of upset that it happened?
Yes.
So you have not just, you know, maybe taken some off your bucket list. You've had an epiphany?
I had an epiphany. I had a realization. I had to step out of denial and into reality. And a lot of people of color, Black people, we have a lot of trauma, and we just call it Wednesday because we've been programmed to believe that we can just take it on the chin and we just keep it moving and we keep going. And that there's this like badge of honor that we wear for our trauma. And I was like, no, but I have a right to have internal peace. I have a right to, you know, own forgiveness. I have a right to designate forgiveness to whoever I want to give it to and who I don't want to give it to. And you know, I don't want to be driven by doctrine and, you know, religious talk that has never served me. So I made some decisions and I'm glad I did, because of that, I've been able to process and just put some things behind me.
That's how you do it. That's how you do it. I plan to talk to you maybe about sinners a little later on, but the blues not only is visceral, is integral, is, you know, it's sphincter tight, inbred into everything that we are. It has a purpose that people don't really pay attention to. When you ain't got time to be sad, to be off and just wallow in my pain. Okay, I got to get this shit over with. So put on these sad ass records, pour me a drink, and leave me the fuck alone.
Yes, right.
Okay? Let me cry it out. Let me get it out of my system. Then let me find somebody who will tell me it's okay.
Yep.
And I can get up in the morning and keep on moving. And what you were saying earlier about we feel like we have to always keep going and stuff, that's a double-edged sword. Because, yeah, you get tired as hell. But you know you from people who not only can, will, and you got more advantage than they do, so you can go better and do further. Or you know what I mean. So I get the, yes, take the rest. It's radical. That's a radical thing. I ain't going to work. I don't care. I'm not feeding your system today. I'm just not doing it. Do that.
That's right.
But understand that whenever you feel like you're ready, you can get up and make shit happen. You know, you turn thoughts into a thing. You have a living book that's always going to have your voice. And that's what we do. So what's your next project?
So right now I'm working on my latest hour of stand-up that I want to record. And I'm developing some television stuff. And as you know, that just goes and goes until it happens. And I'm doing some acting stuff, which I'm really excited about. I'm working on a film and, you know, doing other things. I feel like a lot of my activism, a lot of my revolution, a lot of the things, which I think is interesting that people call revolution and things that are militant, is us just asking to be treated fairly and get equity. Like, I can't believe that it is positioned as being revolutionary to say, can we just live? Can we just eat? You know? But so I'm learning that there are other ways to incorporate that and use my voice. And that is in writing scripts where characters are saying things and, you know, I don't have to deal with the foolishness that of a comedy club person telling me, you know, we would rather that you didn't do that here. We would rather you stick to comedy. Yeah. So I'm like, there are several ways to skin a cat. So I figured out I'm going to make sure that this stuff lives in everything that I do, because it's just, and I think you understand this, it's who I am. Like when I see people who, you know, their comedy is very light and fluffy and airy, there is nothing I can do to try to do that that will come across. It will feel disingenuous. I am heavy. That's who I am. And it took me a while to be able to accept that, you know, being in spaces where people are like, why you always got to bring that up? And I'm like, it's who I am. And it's just okay.
And it's what it is. So yeah, I'm going to bring it up. Why you always got to ignore it? Why you always got to turn it out on me? As you know, this, again, we are so used to framing a narrative one way that we cannot think a different way. Why are you always on your phone? You just on your phone all the time. Now, if I was in the library reading the same shit I'm reading on this computer, on this phone, you would be talking about how industrious and what a student I am and how much I'm so deep and I'm thinking, and you got to change your mind. This tool is a marvelous tool and a testament to humanity's capacity to imagine and create. So yes, embrace it. But everything has its ups and downs and goods and bads. And it was so funny. My next question to you before your last answer was, who are you now?
I am exactly who I've always been, just a better version of it. You know, someone told me once, self-love is beautiful, but self-acceptance is freedom. And I think that for me, finally accepting who I am and all that I am has been such a journey, because especially as a comedian, from the moment I started doing stand-up, I've always had some man in my face coaching me or trying to give me notes or tell me what I should be doing or what I shouldn't be doing as a stand-up comedian. And honestly, it was so exhausting to hear someone who I think is not as smart as me, not as funny as me, just been doing it longer than me, which by definition probably makes them insane, tell me this is what you should be doing. And this is not even arrogance. This is coming from the most humble part of me. But it just got exhausting to, you know, you shouldn't talk about sex, because women that talk about sex, the low comedy, it's just all the stuff that women are constantly being told. And in comedy, it is just tenfold. I had to really just take a step back and just work on some internal stuff, because I was doing a lot of external stuff. You know, I was on the Young Turks talking about politics, making these videos, being very active, going to Politicon, going to, you know, protests, doing all of this stuff. But the inside was struggling. And I had to take a pause, which is what people have been witnessing, and really work on the internal stuff, my personal trauma, so that I wouldn't show up being disingenuous for this stuff, just not me looking for a place to exercise my pain, rage, and anger, as opposed to really being more strategic and calculated about how I want to, you know, how I want to impact the world that we live in and make it better for the people coming behind us. And
what is your joy? What is your joy?
Joy for me, first of all, salsa is joy for me. You put on some salsa music and give me some room, I'ma dance until I fall asleep. My family is joy. And when I say my family, is the family I've chosen, my children, the people who I've chosen, not the ones that were forced on me. And I was told that I had to love and like, just being able to make those discoveries, that's joy for me. Watching a good movie is joy for me. I love art. I love experiencing other people's art. I like to be in community. Stand-up comedy is hard because it's a solo sport. So I miss, you know, not having community. That's joy for me. And, you know, joy for me is children and seeing children experience peace and love and that kind of stuff. Like all the things that I didn't feel I had access to when I was a child is joy for me.
It's okay. It's okay. And I'm happy to hear that. How did you get started in this business?
So I've been in the entertainment business for a very long time. I've always wanted to be in the entertainment business. I never wanted to do anything else wholeheartedly. And I started modeling when I was 14 years old. It didn't fulfill me. I felt, you know, bored. I would be at the fashion show, sitting in the back, surrounded by people that I couldn't connect with. I started doing stand-up in 2008. I went on stage in Arizona at the Orpheum Theater with Bernadette Stannis, Thelma from Good Times. I did this comedy show. I did 5 minutes of comedy, never had done stand-up before, like on stage. And I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to do this forever. And I've been doing it ever since. And, you know, I moved to LA to be an actress, but comedy came after. And when I started doing comedy, I just started doing comedy. Comedy is something that can be addictive once you start doing it. And I was like,
Little Ida in here. Little Ida wants to know how to express her desire to be out front. She wants to know, and she doesn't know that's okay. She doesn't know anything about how or nothing. What are you going to tell her?
How to take that out. I don't know. I don't know what I would tell her, because my initial instinct is to protect her and to be like, no, go do something else. But, you know, what I would tell any young person, including little Ida, is go as you, because you are going to eventually show up anyway. So why waste that time?
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, I think I don't know how much you know about what's going on TikTok or whatnot, but there's a little girl who was doing the boots on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
A little Miss Shirley. Well, they've started calling CPS on her mother.
I saw that.
For making those videos.
It's so nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Aw.
You gonna show us how to line dance?
Yeah.
All right.
I see everybody asking a $1 million question. Who called CPS on Miss Shirley's mama?
Guilty.
I didn't know her mama was going to get on live crashing out afterwards. And quite frankly, I don't give a damn. On my mama, I ain't never had this many people mad at me at one time in my life. I'm not even going to lie. I was already scared for the little girl while she was doing boots on the ground, goddammit. But then I saw that little Johnny Gill put on your red dress and your high heel videos. And nah, man, I picked up my phone immediately. It's one thing about us talking about this shit every day, but I feel like somebody had to take action. I mean, it ain't really that bad either. If CPS find out it ain't no case, they gonna drop the case. But if they find that it is a case, then maybe I did do the right thing. One day, Miss Shirley gonna find this video, and she gonna thank me one day. She had that little girl putting her boots on the ground, goddamn, and I put my foot down. And don't judge me either, man. I was just looking out. Shit, if anything were to happen to that little girl and all of us grown-ups was just sitting there watching and didn't say shit, goddammit, then we would be just as guilty as the mama. And for all y'all that's mad at me, I don't care.
And I feel some kind of way about that. This child is not sexualizing this. You are sexualizing her and right. What she's doing. She's dancing, that's how it looks to her. So that's how what she wants to do, and then she does it. I mean, I haven't seen the things that are making the Christian people's hair catch fire, but it's like in this society, how do you nurture and protect marginalized American children? How do you stoke their dreams and still protect them from the realities that they're going to have to make them come true in, you know? And that's a very difficult kind of thing. Seems like you figured it out and are doing very well. And I'm glad to hear that and see that. I do have a question, though, that might sound a little weird. Mm-hmm. You're a very attractive woman and you do stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy was traditionally where women were concerned. Women were supposed to make themselves unattractive because attractive women are not funny. And this was the law, sure. You know. Mm-hmm. How do you channel that? Do you ever back away from your allure to, you know, not have it compete with your sense of humor? Or do you just take it for granted? How do you deal with it? Or does it ever come into your consciousness?
Well, you know, of course, I've been objectified in a way. When I did Last Comic Standing, when Wanda Sykes produced, Kena Ivory Wayans was one of the judges, and he actually told me that I was distracting and it was my job to tone down the distraction, because when you're a comedian, you shouldn't distract the audience. And, you know, I had to think about that because it was funny because I was wearing a yellow dress and the dress was not suggestive in any way. And even if it was, that would have just been what it was, but it wasn't. But it was funny because he was sitting across from me wearing a blazer with no shirt on under. And, you know, he had his bald head and he was all, you know, his nice look. He looked like very sexy. And he was telling me like, hey, you need to tone it down.
Right.
And we laughed about it, he and I, you know, we talked about it and we laughed about it. But I think, you know, it's interesting, especially when it comes to women of color and Black women, we are constantly being policed by about everything. Because Lucille Ball was an attractive woman who was very funny and was doing all kinds of goofy stuff, but wore her dresses and her red lipstick and her mascara to accentuate her big blue eyes. And, you know, you see all of those women from back in the day wearing their gowns, doing comedy. And Joan Rivers was wearing designer wear. And then, you know, here we come along with those, you know, Maya Angelou, why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I got diamond oil of wells pumping in my living room. Now I got to tone that down. And I just made a decision to be funny. And I was like, I remember just telling myself, comedians host the Oscars. And when they host the Oscars, they got to wear a gown. They got to wear a tuxedo. They don't go on stage wearing a hoodie. You ain't never seen a comedian host the Golden Globes wearing, you know, a sweatsuit. They are always wearing, you know, gowns, or they, Tina Fey is a gown. And so I was like, you prepare yourself for the show. That's what you do. And if you want to wear a dress, you wear a dress. And if you want to wear some jeans, you wear some jeans. The focus is the jokes. That's the icing on the cake. You focus on the cake and then you put whatever icing you want on it.
Well, I'm just, you, Kim Whitley, thousands of other women, especially that I work with a lot, Black women, stunning, okay? And you can try to not be stunning, but you're going to be who you are when you walk in the room. And so my thing has become, and why I founded the Church of Jesus and why I want women to feel their power, is fuck all that.
That's right.
Be all that. When you feel like you just want to be just dressed down, be dressed down. When you feel like you want to knock every motherfucker in the room out with your presence, knock every motherfucker in the room out with your presence. And be who you are the way you want to be. And fuck all that. Too much noise in our ear that we've been taught that we have to abide by this whole, like I said, puritanical, patriarchal mindset that don't make no damn sense. I don't want to do what you, I don't want to go out compete every day. I want to do the woman thing. So anyway, we can talk all night. My sons are like back there going, when are you going to? So I want to introduce them to you and let them say hello. So first of all, I want to introduce, I think I'll start with my baby boy. My baby boy. We're gonna play a little video to introduce him as he is. Skills. Now, Skills, I want you to say hello to my friend Ida. Ida, say hello to Skills Hudson.
What up, famo?
What up, famo? We got history, Skills and I.
Back like my hairline, I think.
Go back like Cadillac seats. Anyway, or a pressing curl. That's my favorite. We go back like a pressing curl. Anyway, before we get into this, I want you to say hello to my oldest son. Looks just like, he looks like his dad too, but he's going to tell you he's got something to say.
Hi. Do you drive a car? You do, don't you? Yeah, and you had to go to school for that maybe, and you also had to take a driving test, and you also had to take a written test. You had to do all kinds of things to be able to get that car, and you have to update your driver's license and all kinds of things, right? So if you know how to drive a car, then you should also know how to push a grocery shopping cart. Yeah, and if you don't drive, maybe you shouldn't get a cart, maybe you should get a basket. Let me tell you something. It is exactly the same as driving a car out in the street. All you have to do, basically, is look both ways. That's really all you have to do. If you're going down an aisle and you reach the end of the aisle to the main thoroughfare where maybe the meat is or maybe the balls in that big cage are, that's the main thoroughfare, and you are trying to merge onto it. You're not having the right of way. You don't have the right of way. So when you get to the end of the aisle, you need to look both ways. Somebody is probably coming, especially if you decided to shop on a Saturday. So you will get to the end, you look left, you look right, and then if somebody's coming, you let them go first because they're on the main intersection. You are not. You are not. And then you get angry. People get angry when they're coming out of the aisle and people don't stop. They don't have to stop. They're going forward. You're merging in. That's your fault. That's your problem. You need to wait. Ah! And then also, when you're in the aisle, let me ask you like this. When you're in the street, do you park your car in the middle lane? Hell no. You park it on the side, on the shoulder. If you need a can of beans, you don't leave your cart in the middle of the aisle while you're deciding what beans you're gonna get. Ugh! Then everybody has to go around you, and then everybody's going, sorry, excuse me, I'm sorry, excuse me. And what they're really thinking is, you're an asshole. Why did I decide to shop on a Saturday?
Rah! Steven!
Hey!
I want you to say hello to our guest.
Hi, Ida.
Hi. Steven Roberts.
Yes.
I see it.
Yeah. It's definitely there.
Okay. Now, we all worked together for a minute at the L.A. Comedy Club, right? And the first time was, I don't know if it was the first time, but it was with Cookie Ho.
Cookie Ho.
Right. And I had a residency on Tuesday. Lovely. Prime time. 10 o'clock, 10:30. 11 o'clock, 11:30 time. Anyway, it was trying to do a midnight show then, I think. And then, I took pictures. I took pictures of you on stage, and we took pictures outside.
I have them in my phone.
You do? I do, too. We're going to play them, because I look for them. And Skills, we were a trio back then. It was... me, Steven, and Skills. So, Skills, what do you have to say?
I didn't really have a question because I enjoyed y'all banter back and forth. And then just to piggyback off of that, when she had started, I had started maybe, I think, like a year like before. And so we was all like new at the same time. And the camaraderie, especially like we had like a 4 or 5 of us that we were always, and I was married at the time, but I was driving all the way out there to be with them. And Ida was like the mother of all of us. You know what I'm saying? She would, you know, keep us, you know what I'm saying? You know, she was loving and everything. But then also, I remember the first time I seen you dress up, I was like, damn, famo. Because she would just always be herself all the time. But when she dressed up, she could dress. And then I remember when you, your birthday party that you had over there in Hollywood, you remember we all had on black?
Yep.
But yeah, it's just brought back memories just hearing you and certain things, and knowing like those times that you would, we go through stuff, but to go through stuff, but still go at it and be out there in the bars and the clubs. I remember the first time you came out there to that show I was hosting out there in Covina, that little bar, the Whale.
Yeah. I had a show every Tuesday, and we would occupy the space at the Hollywood Studio Bar and Grill, and it was me and Skills and Clayton. We had a cool friend, Jabari. So we would always go there to work out our jokes, and we formed this group. It was and we had this bond, and we were always together. So we have a lot of memories. Skills would go to Chicago, and I mean, he would check in, and we were very close. We still are. We're still family.
Yes. And I remember when the first time was like when individuals would get on a show, a big show on TV. I remember when you got on Def Jam, you know what I'm saying? And you know, it just being there for the tapings and stuff like that, man, and auditions, and it was,
you know, both deserve everything you've accomplished, and I see so much ahead for all of my children. I'm very, very happy that we're friends. I always want to be mom, unless you need me to be, and then I'm more TT, you know, auntie than mommy, but I can step in and rub a back or two. Steven?
Yes.
I know you usually have some very, you know, well thought out scholarly questions that you dug deep for. Now watch him ask you if you like Corn Pops or or Cap'n Crunch. Steven?
Well, first thing I want to say is don't stop dressing the way you dress, because I loved what you wore in They Ready, Tiffany Haddish's special. I thought that was fantastic and set you apart, and we knew who you were immediately, and I love it. So you just keep doing you, because I think that's wonderful. So you may not want to answer this question. If you don't want to answer it, it's okay. Therapy?
I'm in therapy every Tuesday. Yep. I'm in therapy. I've been, you know, I've had a lot of loss. So I didn't know how to process loss, because I was so busy taking care of other people that I never grieved my own losses, because I was too busy. Especially when I was a kid, I lost my uncle, who was very instrumental in my life. And when I was writing my book and I was writing about him, I cried like a baby. And I was like, I never got a chance to really mourn his death, because my grandmother had lost her child. My mother had lost her brother. My cousin had lost her father. And I never realized that I was a person in that too, because I was always taking care of other people. So I have a great therapist. And I had therapy today. And I think that, thank God that I decided to go to therapy and to be careful the kind of therapy that I went. Because I've been to several therapists, and I would just walk out the room and be like, yeah, this ain't it. Like I just walked into a department store and walked right out. I've done that with therapy, because I was like, this is not good for me. But yes, I'm in therapy.
Because
was it important for you to have a woman therapist or a Black therapist or somebody who had something else in common with you?
My therapist is a Black woman. And I think there was something important about her understanding and respecting my boundaries. Like, I went into a therapist's office, and the first thing she asked me was, do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? And I was like, let me go. You know, I was like, I just felt like this is not therapy for me. And I already felt judged immediately. But yeah, I wanted someone who understood my language. I don't code switch. So I have to be able to be with somebody who is fluent in what I speak.
Okay.
I'm always going to be me wherever you put me. So if you don't want me to not, if you want me not to be me, then don't ask me to come, because I'm not going to.
I understand that. I know how some people can take that little bit of information and make it all your whatever, whatever. To make an analogy that I was going to make a little later, when we see sinners and we feel like it's packed with all kinds of little goodies and Easter eggs, and I mean, it's really not. It's just culturally true. It just has, in the mainstream movies, everything in there is perpetuates the image that they want perpetuated. And so we're used to them as being normal. And so we just think those are normal. Well, now here's a film with our normal in a way that don't explain, is that it's not about that. It's just there. So we pick up on all those cultural relevant things that we've never seen. And so now they're important, but they're really not. They're just telling the story with a different narrative. And so when you have a therapist or a doctor or somebody who can relate to you in that way, it's just shorthand. And that shorthand builds a trust, you know. They understand. I don't have to sit here and explain what a gay man goes through, what a black man goes through. I don't have to explain that. You walk in and go, hey, what's up? You just kept walking in, you know. And so we can skip past the bullshit and get to the reality. I think we could talk about learning how to love yourself and each other for hours. And I think that's a conversation that we should have more of. And Ida, you have a podcast now?
I do. You got to come do it. It's called Say What You Mean. And it's a 30-minute podcast where people stop by and say the things they wish they would have said that they didn't. And some of the stories are funny. Some of them are angry. Some of them are sad. But it's just a moment of like a lemon squeeze where, you know, some of them are very like very minor, where somebody was like, hey, this lady at the grocery store moved my stuff out the way and jumped in front of me. And I wish I would have just said, hey, I was here before you. Let me go. How dare you? And then somebody, Kwame, the rapper from the 90s, he said that his brother was queer and he died of AIDS. And he said he wished he would have told his brother, I love you and I accept you, because his brother passed away. Like, they range, but it's just interesting how many people are walking around with things that they wish they would have said that they didn't.
Yeah.
And that's what we deal with on the show.
Well, I am so happy you came, and it's been great talking to you. And it sounds like you just kicking ass and taking names and doing it from a Barca lounger, you know, kind of like, I'm cool with me, and this is how I do, and that's be celebrated. You know what? It never stops. We do this thing. This stand-up comedy is therapy on stage. It's therapy when you, as you write, every step of it is self-awareness, and it never stops. I want to tell y'all, I'm 71 years old. I am still trying to love my inner child. Sometimes she's in control. So we are still reconciling those old hurts. We're still opening those little cabinet doors where we put really sensitive things, and they, you know, pop up. They still pop up. So just go with the flow. Get used to it. It's just part of the ride.
Okay. How old did you say you was again, Ma?
I am 71. How old are you?
Damn! No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
And I had my mentor. His name was Jim Cook. He was a comedian out of Philadelphia, and he was like 20 years older. He was my parents' age. And when people were still in that put your age down thing, he was like, no. I mean, look at it. I want credit for every wrinkle you see. I want every day I've been here. I want respect for every day I've been on this earth. So no, I am this old. I am every day a 71, and I hope to keep on collecting days. Steven, Skills, Ida, thank you so much. We're going to stick around and we're going to let you go to sleep with our things.
I'm about to go right now because now you got me, you got the wheels turning. But thank you so much for being here. I manifested you because you are one of the people that I always wanted to meet. So when I went to Vegas and I sat and watched your hour of stand-up, I was, it was a surreal moment for me because I've always seen you. I've always heard you. It gave me permission to be who I am in stand-up, to be able to, you know, you always hear about these men, but you've been doing it and you did it for a long time. The greatest compliment I got in comedy was from Mike Epps because he said, you remind me of Marshall Warfield. And I was like elated. Because I was like, that was the greatest compliment. So I just want to say thank you because you blazed a path that I've had the privilege to follow. And thank you for all of, for being brave and being funny and smart and powerful and unapologetic. You.
We had Karima Westbrook on last week, and she was saying that Whoopi to her gave her that permission as a child, that she saw somebody that looked like her, that was upholding all of the things she wanted to be and see. And the fact that anything you do and everything you do has the opportunity to impact somebody and many, many somebodies, you know, that's not the goal we set. But isn't that a great feeling to know that there are people watching you be you and it gives them permission to be them? Because I ain't did nothing to you, gave you nothing. All I did was beat me. And that's so right. That's a wonderful gift to have. And I you got it in, I won't say in spades because that's racist. So...
But thank you, though. I wanted you to know. I always try to tell you that because I think it's important to give you.
Oh, you can't tell me too much. Now, you know.
I'll never stop.
But, you know, hey, and back at you.
You did it. You know, I opened for Paul Mooney, but I always say you do it with grace. And everybody can do that. You know,
we have to make that happen. You know, I would love to make that happen, too. Work with you.
Same. It would be my pleasure.
Well, we've said it, so let's make it a thing. Okay. Yeah. Right. Good night, honey. Thank you so much for coming.
All right. Love you guys.
Love you too.
All right, Tomo.
So, how many things did I forget to ask her?
I don't know. What did you want to ask her? That was a great interview. I thought you covered it all.
No, so much. You know, we didn't really talk about her family or about what's in the book. Yeah, I don't think we even mentioned the name.
Well, yeah, the name of the book is Legitimate Kid.
Legitimate Kid.
And you can get it on Amazon as well as other places. So
and get it. But see, I was so concerned that I was going to get it mixed up with David Jenkins' book, Legitimate. Oh. Illegitimate.
Okay.
Is that it? Illegitimate? I knew that we've had two authors on with these kinds of cathartic biographies. And I'm happy to know them both. And I got to catch up on my reading. But like I was saying about centers having so many culturally authentic aspects that may or may not have been meant to accentuate a particular point, they might just have been authentic depictions of something. And considering that as opposed to the stereotypes we grew up with, because we think of stereotypes as being demeaning and just exaggerated for laughs or, you know, evil purposes. But everybody's a stereotype. The leading man is a stereotype. This is not a depiction of a real human being. This is someone we made up with the body, with the qualities we want him to have, and the dutiful wife, and all of those stereotypes we've come to accept. And we value more. We pay the leading man more than we pay someone else who might be the more pivotal character. But we have these images that we expect, we're taught to aspire to, and we don't see another way to be. So in your world, if you had a skills world and you had a Steven world, what would it look like? For real, what would it look like in your world? Skills?
When I did my hand like that, that meant for Steven to go first, but I'll go first.
Okay. Well, thank you.
35.
If I could have my own world and it would all work the way I would want it to work, I would, there would be no marriage recognized by the government. It would, there would be no governing of social contracts. There would be, if anything, if there were going to be any governing of things, you'd have to pass a test to be a parent. You'd have to pass a test to be a psychological test to be a mom or a dad. There would be a pointed effort to not distinguish between male and female in the ways that government does that.
He's a person. It was a person.
Yeah. Well, you know, not like that. I mean, when you're identifying somebody, yes, of course you need to be able to give a general explanation of what they look like, but I'm talking more about on the level of what matters and what does not matter. And, you know, when it comes to doing a job, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. It doesn't matter. And if we could change the context by which we think, I mean, that takes decades and ages and centuries to be able to do something like that. But I think that's what the world is talking about right now, and I'm there, and I'm here for it. So,
okay,
yeah,
there'd be no gender, and there'd be no marriage. It'd just be a lot of people fucking.
I mean, can you think of anything better? Can you imagine?
So, you know, somebody got to cook.
There'd be no war.
Somebody, you know, you said a mouthful. Skills. You still don't know what your world look like?
Yeah, no, my world would look like, first of all, in the government sector, we would elect a president. You got to win the championship this year or out of there. I would want, like, everybody, just how you was, like, y'all was talking today, also, Mom, from your story, and people that don't have stories similar like that, to make them feel like you can be your true self, and you don't have to be hide behind something years later, then you end up being your full self. Like, for example, I was watching this documentary about Paul Rubens that played Pee Wee Herman, and right. I was a big fan, I mean, still is, but from my as a kid, but when and he had went through those things, this documentary, he was able to explain like the stuff that I didn't even know, the pain that he went through. You know what I'm saying? You know, not being able to love out open, you know, to his character being bigger than him as the person that created the character. And, you know, and so that's what my world would be like. People being able to be their true self and president each year, and eighths of weed being $10.
Okay. Why not free? Why not free? Like, why you gonna put a price on it? Why not just?
Because I want to give capitalism a little something.
Oh, give capitalism a chance. Well, there you go. I don't know. This is my world. This is the world I created. This is the way I see it. Where you get together at midnight, have a drink, and kick over. You know, kick around some positivity. Some, you know, that feels really subversive nowadays. You know. Can we talk about just being happy? Can we talk about joy? I mean, is it allowed? Is it still okay? It's like nobody, or at least it's not coming through in my algorithm. that there is hope, that there is happy, that there is cooperation, that we can do this. So thank you for being with me. And I want to play, and this is kind of a pickup. I have a video about the stereotypes versus the reality of, and how we can make a different reality. Let's take a look, see what it do to you.
Well, hello. Let's talk Sapphire.
When I started this series, I spent a lot of time explaining that the entertainment industry here in the United States has pretty much always been the propaganda arm of white supremacy. Because it's not what happens that counts, it's who tells the story about what happens that counts. So some stereotypes, like the white man hero stereotype, always exalt white men. This is usually the guy in the movie who kills the most people for the best reasons. Then you have the stereotypes about the women in the white man's life. The dutiful, yes, dear wife. The happy, free-loving bimbo. The longtime friend. The wacky, beloved aunt. You get the idea. Like the good buddy, best friend, and the bad guy, villain, and all of the other tropes, disposable tropes in most movies, your wingman, etc. All these stereotypes of people you're just supposed to take for granted and as knowing their place. But when it comes to depictions of black people, those are generally mean. So big-hearted, large-breasted women, matronly women who are nurturing and caring and indispensable around the house are seen to be negative, a mammy, a less-than-attractive, non-sexual woman. And beautiful, attractive, vivacious, voluptuous young women at the peak of their sexual allure are seen to be hoes. Predatory Jezebel hoes. But in the 1950s, outspoken activist black women became Sapphire. She's the angry black woman. That her anger is justifiable is never acknowledged. I made these videos at a time when I was going through my own emotional weight, at a time when I was trying to build my career and come back after a layoff, and my sister was not well. And so I was not always as thorough as I should have been. But the essence of what I was trying to say is still there. And so that's why I brought them out. I think they're still relevant, and I think it's like playing the cult of personality again, you know. Hey, that still rocks. It's still correct. And these things are still relevant. So that's why I wanted to incorporate them tonight. And anyway, famos, where are you going to be? Steven, I know you were talking about your roast battle. How'd that go?
Yeah, I had the roast battle, and I decided to let Joe have it because I know that he just had a kid and he's very tired. So I knew that I should just let him murder me and have a win because the man needs a win. So I got murdered by Joe Calise, absolutely torn to shreds. And that was my service work for the year.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, you're still you're good with the spirits.
Yeah.
You,
I've got a couple of corporate shows coming up this weekend, but I'll be at Jimmy Kimmel's with Butch Bradley at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, the 28th.
Okay. Well, have a wonderful show, and I'm always happy to see you. Gills, where you at? Where you going to be? What you doing this week?
Weekend, 30th and 31st, Chicago, and here in Vegas.
All right. Well, and then we're going to get together and do this all again. I thank you both for being my wonderful, wonderful sons. We've had quite a ride so far, and let's keep on going. And I will see you next week. And Ida Rodriguez, all the best to you. Thank you for being here. Boricua. And my wife says hi. And we're going to have a last word. Surprise me. Everybody take care. Say good night, Dick. Good night, Dick.
My last word is joy to the world.
Thank you. Good night, Skills. Good morning. I just got done taping an episode of my podcast, Midnight in the Marchverse, with my two sons, Stephen Roberts and Skills Hudson, and our special guest this week, Ida Rodriguez. Great show, but I had a terrifying thought. Now, this thought is not related to the podcast in any way, but it dawned on me that, 3 months into it, however long it's been, 5 months, six, it seems like 800 years. But Donald Trump has gotten boring. It's never been fun, but at least, you know, there was something to get excited about. It wasn't fun excitement, but it got your blood boiling and woke you up in the morning. But crazy is normal now. And that scares the fuck out of me.